ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hello, welcome to PM. I'm Samantha Donovan, coming to you from the lands of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation in Melbourne. Tonight, the Commonwealth Government agrees to a massive settlement for the victims of robo-debt. Also, the former Victorian Premier Daniel Andrews defends his appearance at the huge military parade in Beijing. And sales of Chinese cars booming in Australia.
Without question, the product is getting better and better and better. So you've got a really strong price war, which is terrific for buyers because you now get more car than you've ever had before.
First this evening, the federal government has agreed to settle a class action brought by robo-debt victims for $475 million. If approved by the federal court, it'll be the biggest class action payout in Australian legal history. Robo-debt was an automated government scheme introduced by the coalition government in 2015 that wrongly demanded thousands of welfare recipients pay back benefits. Its victims and their families say they feel vindicated by the agreed settlement. Rachel Mealy reports.
Robo-debt was an illegal debt collection system which ran from 2015 to 2019 under the then coalition government. Nearly 500,000 Australians were caught in its net. Felicity Button was one of them. She says it's taken a long time for today to come.
Justice prevailed, and for the first time, I think, in my whole life, I can say that there was a bit of fairness, not just justice, in our system. Often you can't weave those two terms together when it comes to the law, but today felt fair.
In 2017, Felicity Button's bank account was emptied by Centrelink. More than $11,000 was withdrawn to service an apparent Centrelink debt. She told the Royal Commission into the robo-debt scheme that her money was set aside to pay her rent and buy medication for her child and was wrongfully taken from her. She says when the money was withdrawn, she considered taking her own life. Today, she says she's thinking of all the families whose lives were changed by robo-debt.
I'm thankful and I am so relieved that it came to this point, but at the same time, there's a bittersweetness to it. Thinking of the people that have had irreparable damage happen, people that have lost family members, people that have gone through divorce, become bankrupt, irreparable mental health issues that have stemmed from this, we can never compensate for that. But this is as just and as fair as it could have been.
Today's settlement, if it's approved by the federal court, brings the total cost of robo-debt to more than $2.4 billion. $112 million was paid in compensation from the first class action, which was settled in 2020. But when the Royal Commission handed down its report in 2023, Gordon Legal, the firm behind the first class action, filed another one, claiming damning new evidence had been revealed. Today's settlement means the Commonwealth will pay victims $475 million to compensate for the scheme's harms. Gordon Legal founder Peter Gordon says it's a good result.
Today is a day of vindication and validation for hundreds of thousands of Australians afflicted by the robo-debt scandal. Today, they know that their voices have been heard. Today is also a day of warning to governments and bureaucrats at all levels not to recklessly and unlawfully attack the people who elected them or whom they were hired to protect.
He says victims of robo-debt will need to come forward to be assessed for benefits from the compensation payout.
More than 450,000 Australians have or will benefit from this settlement. It is, of course, far and away the largest class action settlement in Australia's history. Whether you look at the number of group members who will benefit, the amount of today's settlement, or the result overall over the last 4 years. And while it is satisfying for lawyers to achieve a total result of $2.4 billion, it is frankly infuriating to know that our own Commonwealth government caused so much suffering to its own people and that it arose out of willful misconduct.
Attorney General Michelle Rowland says it's the right thing to do.
Today's settlement demonstrates this government's commitment to addressing the harms caused to so many Australians by the former Liberal government through their disastrous and illegal robo-debt scheme.
The settlement payments come on top of the $1.8 billion in unlawful debts that were forgiven.
And yet the most significant cost of robo-debt cannot be measured in dollars and cents. It can only be measured in human terms, because the robo-debt scheme destroyed lives. The Albanese government has been left to clean up this shameful mess left by those opposite, and that's exactly what we're doing.
Bill Shorten is the former government services minister who called for a royal commission to investigate the robo-debt scheme. He's since left the government and is now the vice-chancellor of the University of Canberra.
So I feel really pleased, but again, nothing changes the fact that it should never have happened. It was an abuse of power and the government covered it up.
The Australian Council of Social Service has welcomed the news of the settlement and has urged the federal government to implement the recommendations of the Robo-Debt Royal Commission in full.
Rachel Mealy reporting. The federal opposition leader Susan Lee has been forced into damage control after the controversial Liberal Senator Jacinta Numpa-Jimpa-Price claimed the Albanese government is accepting large numbers of Indian migrants to boost its vote. Ms Lee has reprimanded Senator Price, who has backtracked on the comments. But her statements have offended many in Australia's Indian community, and Liberal colleagues are worried they may lose the support of those voters as a result. Kimberly Price reports.
Immigration continues to dominate headlines after the March for Australia rallies held around the country on Sunday. The Labor government confirmed permanent migration numbers for the next financial year will remain unchanged at 185,000 people. And late yesterday, Liberal Senator Jacinta Numpa-Jimpa-Price weighed in.
I think Labor like to be able to ensure that they're going to allow those in that would ultimately support their policies, their views, and vote for them.
Speaking to Afternoon Briefing, Senator Numpa-Jimpa-Price was questioned on whether she believes Labor is running a migration program to bolster its voters.
Absolutely. I mean, this is Labor. Basically, it's power at any cost.
In particular, she highlighted Indian migrants.
There is a concern with the Indian community, and only because there's been large numbers, and we can see that reflected in the way that the community votes for Labor.
But this morning, Senator Numpa-Jimpa-Price downplayed those comments.
What I was doing was highlighting the fact that there is huge concern for Labor's mass migration agenda, which is applying pressure to housing, to infrastructure, to services. A recent Redbridge poll told us that 85% of those who have Indian ancestry, and that's my children included, by the way, but 85% voted for Labor.
And in another development yesterday, Coalition Senators Bridget McKenzie and Sarah Henderson crossed the floor to support Pauline Hanson's call for an inquiry on immigration. That motion failed. Speaking to Sky News today, opposition leader Susan Lee said the Coalition's migration policy is non-discriminatory.
Every day that I'm opposition leader, I'm fighting for every single Australian, no matter where you came from. And our Australian Indian community are amazing. You contribute as Australian Indians so much to our country.
Despite the opposition leader's statement that there'd be no discrimination, some in the Indian community feel the damage has been done.
I think Senator Price and the coalition will have to work very hard to win back any of the Indian vote.
Pavan Lutra is the CEO of Indian Link, an Australian-based news site for the Indian community.
What we need to be aware is that Indian-Australian voters are politically very sharp. They're coming from the world's largest democratic country. And when they move here, they quickly get a feel for Australia's political environment. And yes, lately many have leaned towards Labour, but so did over 5.3 million Australians at the last elections. Maybe they felt the coalition didn't have much to offer them as new migrants and turned away.
After the weekend's March for Australia rallies, Pavan Lutra says his community is feeling particularly vulnerable.
Susan Lee's comments have been well appreciated, but then this should not have even happened, that she would have had to come and defend one of her senior members of the party.
Minister for Multicultural Affairs Dr. Anne Ali said in Question Time the weekend's rallies had concerned members of the Indian diaspora.
And they've also told me that comments by some political leaders have exacerbated their fear and shattered their sense of security. And I want to say to Indian Australians, this is our message. We stand with you as we always have.
Susan Lee has stated her goal is to align the Liberal Party with business leaders, who she says are predominantly pro-immigration. However, her party's reputation for being tough on migration puts the opposition leader in a difficult policy position, according to Dr. Jill Shepherd. She's a senior politics lecturer at Australia National University.
Now, what that means for Susan Lee is that she doesn't really come into this role with a clear party position on what migration into Australia should look like and what it should be going forward. And that's why they tie themselves in knots. And it's why you get these internal conflicts that we're seeing sort of burst out into public right now.
Following the coalition's election defeat in May and dwindling party numbers, Dr. Shepherd believes Susan Lee has her work cut out in trying to reunify the coalition.
I think there's such deep tensions in the Liberal Party at the moment that they're going to manifest over one issue, whether it's migration, whether it's climate change, net zero, nuclear energy. It's going to be something that brings these conflicts to the fore. And this week it happens to be migration, but it probably won't be that next week.
That's Dr. Jill Shepherd from the ANU. Kimberly Price with that report. The former Victorian Premier Daniel Andrews has defended his decision to appear at a massive Chinese military parade in Beijing yesterday, arguing a constructive relationship with China is in Australia's national interest. Mr. Andrews has been condemned by many figures from both sides of politics for joining the authoritarian leaders of China, Russia, North Korea and Iran for a group photo at the event. As Luke Radford reports, the Beijing event is drawing close scrutiny by observers around the world for a number of reasons.
From China to Canberra, Xi Jinping's grand military parade has gained plenty of attention, and it got Question Time off to a flying start.
Prime Minister, today I once again unequivocally express the coalition's utter condemnation of former Premier Dan Andrews' attendance at the CCP military parade, where he stood with dictators, despots and war criminals.
Opposition leader Susan Lee, quick to ask Anthony Albanese to join with their condemnation of Daniel Andrews. But the Prime Minister wouldn't be drawn.
I haven't and never will meet Vladimir Putin. I haven't and never will meet the leader of North Korea as well. And we will give every support to people fighting for democracy right around the world. That's my government's approach.
Other Labor figures have also been quizzed today, like South Australian Premier Peter Malinauskas, who says Mr. Andrews is a private citizen who can make his own judgments.
Being photographed with Vladimir Putin, who is responsible for bringing war to continental Europe and the invasion of a sovereign country in Ukraine, is not something you catch me doing, that's for sure.
And then late this afternoon, a statement from Daniel Andrews himself, saying that a constructive relationship with China, Australia's largest trading partner, is in Australia's national interest and hundreds of thousands of Australian jobs depend on it. Mr. Andrews raised eyebrows in Australia by appearing on Chinese state television.
In the last few years, the China-Australia relationship has gone from, it was in trouble, it was turbulent, and it was not benefiting anybody. But thanks to the work of the Federal Labor Government, my good friend the Prime Minister Anthony Albanese and his team, we have stabilised, normalised and then stabilised the Australia-China relationship.
Away from Australian politics, the fallout from Beijing's massive military parade has echoed internationally. Officially, it was held to commemorate 80 years since Japan's defeat at the end of World War II, but unofficially, most see it as a display of China's global might. Sam Roggeveen is the program director of the Lowy Institute's International Security Program.
Well, unusual in the sense of its scale, but also in China's willingness to display equipment that is either on the still in prototype or early development stage or only just entered service. The Chinese are typically a bit shy about that, but this was a glimpse, a selective glimpse, not only into the People's Liberation Army that is operating today, but the one we're going to get into the future.
That future? Nuclear missiles, lasers and unmanned drones. Mr. Roggeveen says while the land-based robots are mostly a novelty, the aerial drones are a big deal.
The revelation of four new stealthy drone designs, as you say, they're referred to in the Western defence parlance as loyal wingman drones. So these are drones that are designed to fly alongside manned aircraft and can be tasked by the crews on board the aircraft to undertake additional missions. Some of the designs actually might even be true unmanned aerial vehicles, which can perform complete missions on their own.
One man who was watching on, albeit from afar, was US President Donald Trump.
I thought it was a beautiful ceremony. I thought it was very, very impressive. But I understood the reason they were doing it, and they were hoping I was watching, and I was watching. My relationship with all of them is very good. We're going to find out how good it is over the next week or two.
Russian President Vladimir Putin says he also enjoys his relationship with President Trump.
Well, the US president is not without humor. It's clear. We all know this well. I have a good relationship with him. We communicate with each other on a first-name basis.
In a moment that could have significant repercussions for the ongoing war in Ukraine, North Korean leader Kim Jong-un told his own state media that his country would fully support Russia's army. But even that was upstaged by an unusual unscripted moment between Xi Jinping and Vladimir Putin, who were caught on camera speaking about achieving immortality through organ transplants. Peter Tesh is a former Australian ambassador to the Russian Federation and was a deputy secretary in the Defence Department from 2019 to 2022.
Well, I confess I sniggered. This is the sort of casual conversation, if it's been accurately reported and recorded, that you could imagine two septuagenarians having. There's, of course, been a lot of speculation for a long time about Putin's alleged fascination or obsession with combating aging, but I don't think we should be expecting that there's some kind of dark, malevolent biolab somewhere that is figuring out how to perpetuate aging authoritarians.
Peter Tesh is a former Australian ambassador to the Russian Federation. Luke Radford with that report. This is PM. I'm Samantha Donovan. You can hear all our programs live or later on the ABC Listen app. Well, if you spend much time driving, you may have noticed an increasing number of Chinese-made cars on our roads. And new data from a peak Australian auto body shows you're not imagining it. For the first time, four Chinese car makers made it into the top 10 most sold brands in the country. And they're dominating the electric vehicle and hybrid categories. Diana Damjanovic has this report.
It's the new age of cars in Australia, and the brand names are changing, and companies no one had heard of 10 years ago are rising, like Build Your Dreams, the Shark Ute, and Cherry.
Over a number of years, we've seen an increase in sales of Chinese vehicles, and there are a number of Chinese brands that are dominant in the Australian market, but last month was the first time we've seen four in the top 10.
Tony Weber is the chief executive of the Federal Chamber of Automotive Industries, the peak industry group, which looks at car sales in Australia. For the month of August, its data shows Australians bought more than 100,000 cars. It was the second highest August result ever recorded. For the first time, four Chinese brands, Build Your Dreams or BYD, GWM, MG and Chery are in the top 10 highest selling manufacturers. Automotive journalist at Drive.com, James Ward, says this shows consumers now like what China has to offer.
It is the changing face of the Australian new car buyer. And you've got two kind of things working here. One, Australians love an affordable car. You get great value for money out of some of the Chinese brands. But also, China is a manufacturing powerhouse. And we are seeing more and more brands, not just the Chinese brand, more recognisable global brands using China as a manufacturing base for their products, particularly with electric cars.
Just over 20,000 Chinese-made vehicles were sold in Australia last month, which is 67% higher than the same time last year. One asterisk on this data is that it doesn't include sales by EV maker Tesla. It's claimed elsewhere that it sold 2,927 vehicles in August. While the figures show EV sales are growing, some things are slower to change.
What's your favourite car, Australia?
Holden!
Let me see, that's football, meat pies, kangaroos and Holden cars, huh?
Right!
Australia's long love affair with utes and SUVs isn't over yet. They're still holding 86% of the market. The Ford Ranger was the biggest selling vehicle, followed by the Toyota Hilux and then Toyota's RAV4. When it comes to the success of Chinese vehicles, James Ward cites one example, the Shark Ute made by BYD.
The Shark Ute, which is a plug-in hybrid pickup. Basically, you've got a petrol engine in the front, you've got twin electric motors in it, you can drive it on full electric power, you can use that battery to power other devices. It's kind of cool, it's got plenty of performance, and people are flocking to them. So they're giving people what they want at a price that feels very, very affordable, and they are really walking up the sales charts.
And as for whether Australians are still sceptical about buying Chinese cars, James Ward says people have now decided if the car is good, it doesn't matter where it comes from.
It is one of those things that a lot of people don't ask the question or think about it, but the product, look, without question, the product is getting better and better and better. So you've got a really strong price war, which is terrific for buyers because you now get more car than you've ever had before.
James Ward is a journalist at Drive.com. That report from Diana Damjanovic. The Australian Academy of Science is warning the nation isn't producing enough experts in fields like geology, artificial intelligence and climate science. And in a new report released today, the Academy is pointing out that without that expertise, Australia will struggle to meet the challenges we'll most likely be facing in the decades ahead. Julia Bergen reports.
Be it agricultural science, artificial intelligence, biotechnology or climate research, Australia has a problem. An investigation by the Australian Academy of Science found in some key fields, the level of expertise, research and resources Australia has does not match its needs now or in the future.
The rest of the report is basically saying that as a country, we have to do something. We can't continue to drift along, muddle through and think, you know, she'll be right because in the past, maybe it has been.
That's Professor Ian Chubb, the Academy's chair and previously Australia's chief scientist. He was in charge of delivering this report.
So it's tying the link between what we know, what we need to know, what we have to go and find out, and then to turn it into something that gives benefits to Australians.
The report took key pressures facing Australia in the coming decades, like an ageing population, the economic and physical risks of climate change and rapid digital development, and put them in conversation with the Australia Today and the Australia pitched for 2060. Also with the Australian Academy of Sciences is Hayley Teasdale.
Things like climate science and epidemiology that you might think of as a bit abstract, but they're actually really, really important for things like urban planning so that we can understand how to build homes that keep us warm, that keep us cool, that prevent mold, you know, to create batteries and other technologies that help power our homes for the Australian climate. It's just so important that we have these fundamental sciences to draw on so that we can plan for our future and make sure that we can afford our power bills and afford our grocery bills.
If you were to suggest to high school students the sorts of jobs that they should be starting to think about, what would you say?
I think it's a certainty that they'll find very good jobs in geoscience and material science. If you look to the fundamental science, physics and chemistry, we could certainly use some more Australian graduates in those fields to ensure that we have the capability we need to give us those prosperous lives of the future.
One of the key industries suffering is geoscience. That field covers big ticket items like critical minerals, net zero, renewable energies and battery power. Monash University geoscience researcher Professor Andy Tompkins echoed the report's findings. He says geology funding is being cut, university departments are closing, and student numbers are down.
In geoscience, we've seen in the last 5 years or so, there have been closures at the three geoscience departments, or let's two of them are closed and one's sort of hanging on a little bit. And Macquarie University lost its geosciences group, Newcastle lost theirs, and Wollongong looks like they were going to lose theirs for a little while. I think they might be holding on still.
Although the report does not quantify the dollar value required to meet Australia's scientific needs, Professor Chubb says it's a long way off the $28 billion research and development spend that is consistent across OECD countries. And if Australia does not start investing in its own scientific capacity, the country will suffer.
And if we don't have the capacity, we've got to import the solutions. And other countries don't worry about solutions for the particular Australian context. They're going to worry about solutions for their own context.
Professor Ian Chubb is the chair of the Australian Academy of Science and Australia's former chief scientist. Julia Bergen with that report. Thanks for joining me for PM. I'm Samantha Donovan. The podcast of the full program is available on the ABC Listen app. And we'll be back at the same time tomorrow. Good night.
Hi, it's Sam Hawley here, host of the ABC News Daily podcast. Is the IVF industry one that can be fully trusted, given recent revelations of embryo and sperm mix-ups and women giving birth to strangers' babies? Today, ABC journalist Grace Tobin on her latest investigation into one couple's fraught experience and why the rules need to change. Look for the ABC News Daily podcast on the ABC Listen app.